23rd, 2021 HRSD Commission meeting will now come to order. We will now have a roll call of the HRSD Commission members. Please say here after Ms. Cascio calls your name.
Glenn.
Here.
Lakdawalla.
Yes.
Levinston.
Here.
Rodriguez.
Yeah, here.
Tarosky.
Here.
Ward. Lynch.
Yeah.
Elifson.
Here. Thank you. I understand there are several members of the public on the virtual meeting. We thank you for your interest in observing the meeting. There are a few reminders for today's virtual. Please keep your microphone on mute when not speaking. Hang on a second. The audio of the meeting is being recorded for posting on our website in accordance with FOIA. Before speaking, including when making or seconding a motion, please first state your name. Ms. Cascio will call commissioner names for a roll call vote on each agenda item requiring action. Only public comments pre-registered with Ms. Cascio will be accepted during the call. I understand no one is registered to make public comments at this time. Is that still the case?
That is still the case, Commissioner Elifson.
Okay, we'll go forward with Ted doing awards and recognition.
Thank you very much, and good morning, everyone. And this morning, our first order of business is a service award for Jamie Mitchell. Jamie has been with us for 20 years, which I find really hard to believe. Hired as a young person out of elementary school. February 2001 as a water quality investigator, promoted to water quality specialist. And she's just been on the march upward through our organization over time, promoted in January 2012 to the Chief of Technical Services. She has her degree from a Bachelor of Science and Master's in Biology from Old Dominion. So Vishnu would be happy about that, as we all are. And she's just been a fabulous leader in HRSD and just can't believe it's been 20 years. So Jamie, do you want to say a word or two?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and start my camera too. So thank you for that. Good morning, commissioners and all. A milestone is definitely an opportunity to reflect on two decades of service. It doesn't feel like that, although some mornings maybe it does. But I just want to say I've worked with some amazingly brilliant and talented people that I continue to learn from every day. I look at the applications for people coming into our entry-level positions, and you know, they're just so talented and they have a passion for the environment. I think that vision of achieving clean waters for future generations really speaks to a lot of people, and it certainly speaks to me. And I think that's what I want to reflect on for you all and take the opportunity to reflect that, you know, sometimes having a career that speaks to you isn't enough to allow you to balance home and work challenges. And so sometimes those things collide, but you guys and senior management and the commission have consistently supported that nurturing environment that allows us to balance those two challenges and really stay somewhere for decades where you can find that passion that speaks to you. You know, we have flexible leave policies, flexible work schedules where that's possible, continuing education to nurture the mind, a wellness program that emphasizes self-care. I mean, and you don't see that a lot of places. And then for me, the one that really helps me sleep at night is the health benefit package that you all provide, knowing that you have that ability to care for your family without creating an undue financial burden. You guys have really nurtured and cultivated this environment where we can focus on our jobs and minimize some of those external stressors. And so I just want to take this opportunity to thank you all, because you've really you've consistently supported senior management implementation of a lot of these actions, and we really appreciate it. So thank you. It's been a wonderful 20 years, maybe 20 more, but probably not.
I don't think I've signed a 40-year congratulations letter yet, but I've done several at 35.
Well, it's only five more. I mean, I think they should hold out for the other 40, right? Thank you all. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Jamie. And she mentioned all the bright people she's gotten to work around. And she is one of our superstars and rock stars. And Charles Bott talks about a person as being a rock star, you know, they really are. And Charles has said that many times about Jamie. So anyway, thanks, Jamie, for setting such a great example for everybody.
Hear, hear.
Thank you.
Okay, we're ready to go on to, the next is a new employee introduction. And this is for Dan Holloway. So Dan, in many ways, doesn't feel like a new employee to many of us. He was working with Jacobs, previously CH2M Hill, when we first started Swift. And I don't know how many of you can recall back to that 2014-15 timeframe when we basically asked Jacobs, then CH2M Hill, to do the modeling to say, hey, if we actually did this, would it make a difference? And Dan was the one that did that work and really helped us see that Swift could move forward and do great things for Eastern Virginia, not to mention HRSD. So we've worked closely with Dan over those 5 to 6 years. Some of us have more time around him. He got his BS in geology from James Madison and also master's from Old Dominion. So, you know, we just keep adding those Old Dominion resources. It's great to have that, such a great university close by. But anyway, we're so happy that we could put this job out on the street, and Dan was interested in making a career switch, and he's coming to us from Jacobs after almost 20 years in the private sector, and he's looking forward to being part of our team, and we're certainly looking forward to having him. So Dan, I don't know if you want to say a word or two so you can be seen in your camera.
Yeah, thanks. Mainly just thanks for providing me this opportunity. It's really great to be here. I have a tremendous amount of respect for the HRSD Commission. HRSD is an institution. I echo what Jamie said. There are a lot of brilliant, talented people here. And I'm just really looking forward to, you've been working with you, but working on this side with you guys. I couldn't be more excited about it. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Dan. Really appreciate you being here. Yeah.
Welcome aboard.
Thank you.
All right, I think that's it on awards and recognitions. We'll go on to the consent agenda.
So I understand we had a question about the steam boiler rental, and so we'll jump to that item directly. So this is does represent a bit of a change in philosophy, and I talked to the chairman yesterday during our walkthrough on this. You know, in the past, and I'd say, you know, maybe more of a distant past now, we were super conservative and very redundant. So we built everything with extra major features and parts, and really were concerned about the need to keep things up and running, which we still are very concerned about that. We just can't afford to build redundancy at huge levels into all of our projects going forward. So we're really taking a more managed risk management approach to many of our larger systems. So with the THP, the thermal hydrolysis project at Atlantic Treatment Plant, one of the critical elements is this is a boiler. I mean, you're cooking the solids at very high temperatures. You have to have steam boiler to make that work. But if a steam boiler fails for some reason, you're pretty much out of luck as far as the THP process goes. Now, we could have built two steam boilers, and that would have cost a lot of money, both from overall construction cost, operating the boiler, keeping it in place. We chose to, at least on the near term, to rent, enter into this rental agreement, have a standby boiler available, and it's all piped in, ready to go. So we can just come hook it up and be up and running in very short order if we lost the steam boiler that we have in place. So we don't expect to lose it. This is essentially an insurance policy. Once we expand Canby, which is in our long-range plans, we start bringing more solids from other plants, we will build a second boiler because it'll need it at that point to deal with the capacity. And we wouldn't need this after that point. But in the near term, this rental is our insurance policy for that steam boiler. Any questions on that? So I don't know if there's anything else, Rick, that you'd like us to talk about on the consent agenda.
I think that was the only one that had a question. So hearing none, I need a motion.
Lakdawala moves to approve.
All right, I have Lakdawala with the motion.
Second, Lynch.
Thank you.
So all in favor say yes, and those opposed say no after Ms. Cascio does the roll call.
Glenn?
Yes.
Lakdawala?
Yes.
Levinston?
Yes.
Rodriguez?
Yes.
Hrosky?
Yes.
Ward?
Yes.
Lynch?
Yes.
Elifson?
Yes.
Thank you.
Motion carries. Go on to item three.
Item three, we're going to have a briefing from Jay Burness. This is just great, a good news story. It's the Municipal Utility Relief Program. Jay, I'm going to stop sharing my screen so you can start sharing yours. So we received money from the Commonwealth through the CARES Act, and it got to us a little late in the year last year, but that's how the program was set up. And so we received $8.7 million. So I think we were the second largest recipient in the state. I think Richmond actually got the most. And that's based on information we provided the state based on the total value of the arrearages greater than 30 days at the time. And so posed a huge challenge, and Jay and his customer care team and other finance folks really rose to that occasion. So Jay, with that, I will let you take it through us.
Thanks, Ted. Can everyone hear me okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. So like Ted said, this is a great good news story, but you know I love data, so I'm going to walk you through kind of where we are and what our plan is moving forward. And then towards the end, we do have one ask for some guidance on one issue. But other than that, this is really just a briefing on kind of where we are. So like Ted said, we were awarded $8.7 million. It was about 80 to 90% of what we requested. The way the program worked is the customer had to provide an attestation, meaning that they say that they were impacted by COVID, and we collected that information via an online form. We actually hired a third party call center to get those attestations. Once we had that data, we connected those attestations with accounts, and then that's how we were able to apply payments. So originally we were able to apply it from March of 2020 through December of 2020. But with the latest stimulus bill that was signed into law end of December, they did an extension. So all the CARES money was extended through the end of December of this year. So part of that effort, we did a huge social media blast. We tagged 60,000 homes in 3 weeks, which was a huge effort. And one of the things to note is that we did focus on the folks that were 60 days past due. And the reason why I make a note of that is you'll see that in the data in one of the future slides. So sorry, this is a little bit of a busy slide, but just to kind of walk you through it, this is the table of the amount of money that went out. And so you have HRSD highlighted in green. So this is the amount that just went to HRSD bills. When the program was originally designed, the deadline was January 29th of 2021. And so we were worried that we weren't going to be able to get all $8.7 million out, and you had to return any money that you didn't spend. And so we decided to also apply that to water and sewer bills. And so this is what's in gray is what we applied to water and sewer bills in some of the localities. And so overall, and the main reason was because we wanted to maximize the assistance to those folks as well. And so in return, also some localities also paid HRSD bills. And so that amounted up to $635,000. So the total applied, when you add up how much we applied between the $3.9 million and the $635,000, the total applied to HRSD accounts is $4.52 million. And that's a great win-win when you think about it, because these folks that had the debt hanging over them, not only did we wipe that out, but also on our side, we actually received that money that we may not have ever received from these folks. And so, like I said, it's a great win-win situation. That's the beauty of grants and not loans, is that it doesn't have to be paid back, at least not to our customers. So the total amount that we've spent is $6.81 million out of the $8.7 million. And as you can see, that we probably would have had to send back some of that money had the deadline stayed at January 29th. So this was a good decision when we made it at the time. One thing to note is that this column doesn't add up because, you know, if folks have HRSD bills, but they also have water and sewer bills, so this column won't add up. And there were only like 166 accounts that did not have an HRSD balance but had a locality balance. One of the things to note too is the average HRSD bill that we paid down was $224. That's something to keep in mind when we talk about some of the future numbers. So where was that $3.8 million spent across Hampton Roads? And so it makes sense that Virginia Beach customers had the largest amount. There's like, that's the largest city in Hampton Roads. But all the other large cities also got between 10 and 15%. So you can see that, you know, it was relatively evenly spread across Hampton Roads. But, and you can see it was in the legend below. I mean, there's a smaller pies here, but the money was really spread. Spent across Hampton Roads. So this is the graph that we show in our monthly report. And so what it shows you, since the COVID pandemic started in March, the accounts receivable that was past due continued to grow. And then we had ransomware in December 2020. So that really impacted the 31 to 60 folks because of the billing issue we had. And then if you look at the January bill, you'll notice that we caught up with the billing, but a huge dip in terms of the folks. The green and purple is the greater than 60 days of arrearage. What a hit, what an impact it did for the CARES money after we applied it. So a pretty big impact. So one of the things that I'm gonna do is I'm gonna deep dive into this column on kind of where we stood at the end of January. And so that's what these next graphs are. So sorry, this is a little bit busy, but I'm just gonna just give you the highlights of it. So this is broken down in between active and inactive accounts. Inactive meaning that they still owe us money, but they've moved away. And so they're an inactive account. And so the big takeaway here is these are the different bins on, you know, how much money is due at a certain period of time. But the big takeaway is there's almost 39,000 active accounts that have a past due amount greater than 60 days. That's 8% of our customer base. And that's still after we applied the CARES money. So there's still a significant number of customers that have amounts past due. And then if you look at, this is in terms of number of accounts. And if you look at how much that is, that's greater, the greater than 61 days is 7.8 million is active accounts. And so if you do the quick math and you divide the amount by the active accounts, it's about $202 is the average that folks owe. Still seems relatively small when you think about some of those Texas ratepayers that were on those market-based accounts that owe like $8,000 from the recent ice storm, but still probably a pretty big amount for some of these customers that are still struggling. So given the fact that, you know, we don't have 7.8 million left from the CARES money that we received. And so what we'd like to do is, the big question is, can we absorb the administrative cost? And so when the program was set up, they said that we could use up to 5% of the 8.7 million to pay for administrative costs. And so for us, that was the tagging program. So this first part, you know, if you included salaries and the time and the tags we did, and then the third party call center that we hired, the total amount of allowable reimbursement that we calculated is about $171,000. But really, the total out of pocket is really only $77,000 because salaries, we were going to pay the salaries no matter what. And so one of the questions we'll ask at the end of this presentation is, instead of trying to get this amount reimbursed, can we maximize the amount of money we can help customers? Because the way our current Enabling Act is written is we can't do that with ratepayer funds. And so that could help almost 800 more customers if we just absorb these administrative costs and maximize this 8.7 million to our customers. So that we'll be looking for some guidance from y'all at the end. And so the plan moving forward is We'd like to begin utility shutoffs this summer. If you recall, we applied for that 1% arrearage exemption that was in the General Assembly bill. And so the plan is that when we give people notice that they could be shut off, we still have about 1.1 million, assuming if we absorb those administrative costs to say that, okay, if you have you been impacted by COVID, they can do an attestation, then we could apply some of this remaining money to those accounts. And so we just have to have this money spent by the end of December of this year, which I don't think we should have an issue with. And if we absorb those administrative costs and given how much we have left over, we could probably help about 5,000 customers in this second phase of the program. The reason why it's not the 1.9 million, if you were doing the math from the previous slides, is we've got a second round of payments pending that wasn't done before the commission meeting. We also are manually going through some accounts where they've had leak adjustments. So we don't want to apply CARES money to folks that if they've had a plumbing issue and they have like a $5,000 bill that was really mainly due to leaks, using CARES money for that. And so there's a bunch of accounts that we're trying to manually go through and make sure that those get adjusted before we apply CARES money to that. So also in terms of strategy, when we begin these shutoffs, what we also wanna have in place is the ability to do long and short-term payment plans. And the first one is promise to pay. It's something that we talked to the commission about last year. It's a really easy way that folks can set up a payment plan via a mobile device. I think the best way to think about it is like a micro loan. This is kind of like our long-term up to 24-month strategy. But we also have a couple of short-term strategies. So this is pretty new, the concept of PayPal. And so PayPal has a new program where you can pay in four, where you do it every 2 weeks, 25% of the bill, or PayPal credit, but you have to apply for the credit and it's 0% interest in 6 months. And so the cool thing about PayPal is that HRSD gets the money up front and PayPal takes all the credit risk. Whereas in the promise to pay, they're just making payments and it's kind of like layaway. Like we only get paid the amount of the monthly that customers pay. But for the PayPal option, which is the short-term option, HRSD gets all the money up front and PayPal takes all the credit risk. And so this is pretty new, evolving. Not sure when this is going to roll out. Like I said, this is within the last month or so that we've learned about this option. And then we've also made some edits to our CC&B so that we can easily offer customer assisted payment plans. It's a little clunky the way we have to do it now. So if folks need to call in and they need to walk through how to structure a payment plan, we can do that as well. So these are more mobile options and things that folks can do more online. And then, but we also are finalizing our payment plan process that our customer service reps can help customers with. So with that, like I said, the two key things is, is the commission okay with us absorbing the administrative cost in, just some general guidance on the strategy moving forward. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Jay, this is Commissioner Tarosky. I have a question. Do people usually respond when they receive a utility shutoff notice? Is that when they finally respond?
There's the process too. So you send the reminder notices, but when they get the tag, especially if they've been tagged before, they know that it could be imminent. And I think that's one of the reasons why a lot of folks that are just not paying bills because there's really no repercussions right now because there's been that moratorium. And so I think we just need to give them a nudge to do that. And some folks probably didn't even, bother applying for the COVID program as well. So there's some of those customers that have been impacted by COVID, and so they just need a nudge. And so I think that's what is great about this program, that we still have some money left over that we can really help some of those customers that have been impacted by COVID. We do have some of that money left over. So.
Thank you.
Is it our people that are educating them on like those PayPal options?
Well, so those things are really brand new. And so we haven't rolled out the communication on those yet. But yeah, it's going to be a whole communication strategy.
It's going to be a long phone call per person.
Well, I mean, I've seen the demos of the promise to pay, and one of the reasons why we're really interested in that, it's something that's been rolled out in Louisville. It's really easy for folks to sign up for that and get on the pay plan. And so promise to pay has been around, and they've done like parking tickets and other business lines. And so they've just had a lot of success just based on how easy it is. Now the PayPal is, if y'all have ever paid with PayPal on any other website, it's pretty easy. It's just like, you know, you're choosing which credit card you're gonna use. And instead of a credit card, you just click PayPal. And so that will be a similar look to how that would work.
I see. On our site. So. Another question, what's the taxability of these payments to the recipients? Do you know?
Oh, that's a great question. Ted, you want to take that?
Yeah, sure. So we have been looking into whether it's a taxable 1099
yeah.
event or not. And, you know, the first advice we've gotten is the conservative approach would be, yes, it is a taxable 1099 event, and that we should be sending 1099s out. We've asked, and I've had lengthy discussions with the Sands Anderson tax folks, and I think we're moving forward with the idea of applying for a private letter ruling from the IRS, because we believe this falls into the general welfare exemption for income. And so there are three tests for this general welfare. And one is that, you know, it has to be a government program, which clearly is. Mm-hmm. Two, the individual has to have had a, you know, a disaster or, you know, some issue, and they have to prove it through our attestations. We've done that. And then they, remember the third one, but anyway, we make it through all three of those tests pretty clearly. So the concept would be, we didn't apply any of these payments in calendar year 2020. We didn't start applying money until 2021. Mm-hmm. So we've got some time, but the chances of us getting the private letter ruling in 10 months are pretty remote based on the speed at which the IRS is working right now. But I think our plan is to do everything we can to get the private letter ruling, and then come next January, just before we have to pull the trigger on the 1099s, we'll come back to you with our recommendation, whether we take some risk, thinking that, you know, our private letter ruling will come through, and that, you know, that we can take an approach, and we've got a well-documented and reasoned approach as to why we think it should be exempt from a 1099 income generating event. And so we're working it, but it's a great question, and I would have expected it from our CPA chair. So thank you.
So Jay, does that mean everyone in Portsmouth had paid that bill, that no delinquencies and no need? I didn't see Portsmouth on your chart.
Well, Portsmouth was on there.
Yeah.
Yeah, they got fortune.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay,
they were one of the larger ones.
Yeah, relative to population.
Yeah, when you think relative to population, you definitely got a little more per capita in Portsmouth.
All right.
Jay, why is Suffolk only 7%? They just weren't active to the city government in educating citizens.
I think population-wise, they're a little bit smaller relative to the other cities. But yeah, I'm not sure why.
Jay, they had their own money too.
Yeah, yeah, and all of these localities also, they all have their own money.
So depending on how they were applying their own money, they may have, and they being a joint build group, you know, Model 3, they were likely to be doing paying some of ours as well while they did that. So it was a combination of both.
Right. And one of the reasons why you don't see James City County as a big piece of the pie, they took the stance that they wanted to keep their money totally separate. And so they did not want to commingle the money. So I think they got like $260,000. And so they sent that to us and we applied that for them, but they really didn't want to commingle money. And so they spent $130,000+ of their amount, about 50%. So that's where James City would have been as well.
Well, we still need to address your suggestion on the reimbursement of our salaries.
I don't think we need a vote, but we were kind of looking for guidance. If you all had the appetite for us to just continue to not apply for, or to not apply that as a reimbursement and use it for customer assistance, we would continue down that path.
I would agree with that suggestion, because we're going to pay those salaries anyway. So that's already in our budget. So this would help further customers.
And Jay, how would we absorb this? You talked about where we are budget-wise.
Yeah. Oh yeah. So one of the benefits when we budget for debt service, we assume a certain percentage that we'd be paying in interest. I think for the $50 million variable rate debt, we assumed, I think, 2.25% or something like that. But it's currently at 0.02%. And so we have a little bit of money there that we could transfer to cover these costs. So it shouldn't be an issue.
Yeah, so it's a savings in debt expected budgeted debt service costs that we'd be applying this to. So it's not hitting any other operating budget.
Hey, this is Commissioner Lynch. Calculate our revenues or show in the revenues when we bill out or when we get paid?
So when you're looking at the monthly report, it's all billed wastewater revenue because we are making the assumption that we're going to collect that revenue.
Okay.
So that's why when you're looking at the monthly report, you kind of got to look at two dimensions. You got to look at the billed wastewater revenue, but then you also got to look at the accounts receivable arrearage, in terms of what the revenue will come in at the end of the year. So, and you also got to look at our days cash on hand as well, because that's the cash we have, and so that's really, you know, cash is king. So that's another dimension you really need to keep an eye on. And so everything looks good so far.
So Jay, I didn't hear any objections to your recommendation. So
great.
Not needing a vote. I think you carry on.
Great. We appreciate it.
Jay, can you stop sharing? And we'll have, I think, Lacey or Layla start sharing their screen. So the next item is another good news story. It's the educational outreach during the COVID-19 pandemic. And so, you know, behind the scenes, Lacey Weaver, who's our education specialist, community outreach specialist for education, has really been working hard to find ways to help our teachers that are struggling with how to deal in the virtual world and providing them content and helping them do lesson plans and interesting things in the classroom goes a long way right now. And she's done a fabulous job. So with that, Lacey.
Hi, everyone. Good morning. So my name is Lacey Weaver, and I'm the Community Education and Outreach Specialist. So today, I just wanted to talk to you guys a little bit about how we're continuing our community outreach and education during the pandemic. Okay, so this is just a little outline, like an overview of what we'll talk about and discuss. So just a little background. So when the pandemic hit in March of last year, March, April, the springtime is really the busiest time for our education and outreach. That's usually around Earth Day, and it's also usually when the schools are focused more on environmental education and outreach. So we're usually super busy, so much so that I usually have to request volunteers from other staff within HRSD because I can't handle all the events on my own. So we had a super busy 2020 plan. It was the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. So we were jammed packed with events. And then when the pandemic hit, like with everything else, it just came to a screeching halt. So we were left with the question, how do we continue to do education and outreach even though we can't physically be connected with events and with schools? So I'll just walk through all of these throughout my presentation, and then at the end, you guys can feel free to ask any questions. So the first thing that we did is I revamped the classroom lessons. So we have our HRSD classroom located on our website that teachers, parents, students, they can go to and see a bunch of different lesson plans that they can incorporate into their classrooms. And we give them that option, but I revamped some of these lessons to make it easier for teachers, students, and parents to do. So the reason for that is because before the pandemic, teachers loved when I came into the classroom and I brought materials that students could use to do activities. So depending on the activity, I would bring maybe pH strips or a turbidity meter or something like that, that teachers didn't really have the resources to provide themselves. So it gave students that hands-on learning experience that they wouldn't have otherwise had. But since the pandemic, needless to say, those resources were not easily and readily available for teachers. So I wanted students to be able to do what they could at home. So a lot of these activities include at home items that people can grab. So things like Legos and Ziploc bags, things like that. So all of the, out of the list here that you see, the things with asterisks are new. We also incorporated PDF coloring pages. So working with AskHR Green to try to get some of our activities to be PDFs so that it's easy for students to be able to just kind of print those out at home and work on those coloring pages and activities at home. And then of course our Swift virtual tour. Another thing that happened is that we increased our social media engagement. So I love this statistic. According to research, 46 to 51% of US adults were using social media more since the pandemic began. And we definitely saw that in our analytics. So I include our social media analytics in my monthly reports. And we saw a spike in social media engagement and we tried to use that to our advantage. So on social media, we started sharing lesson plans. So the lesson plans that I showed you from the last slide, we would share those on social media. Also promoting our HRSD classroom so that you know people could have their own pick at which lessons they wanted to include. Promoting our treatment plant tool. So our treatment plant tool is something that I created based on our Your Rural in Quality course. So after that course, I worked with GIS to create a tool where people could type in their address and see what plant serves them. So they can put in their address and find that treatment plant. And it really helps us when people want to request tours, but it also gives people kind of an idea of where their wastewater goes and a few facts about that treatment plant. And that's currently located on our facility tours page on our website. So promoting that as well, promoting the Swift virtual tour. I increased some of our YouTube videos and just our presence on YouTube. And then also using our HRSD Making Waves blog page and creating blog posts. So if you look on this slide, you can see just a few snippets that I wanted to highlight from our social media engagement. So we had 407 new fans on our Facebook page in 2020. So these are people that are now liking our page and following our page. And for us, that's a big deal. That's a big number, having 407 new people in a year. So the next one that you see, this Facebook snippet, this is pretty similar to what I share in our monthly reports. So this is our most popular post of 2020. And you can see that we reached 55,000 people, which again is pretty incredible for us. And it was a post that was created with the toilet paper shortage, just reminding people of what happens when they flush wipes and what wipes look like when they get stuck at our treatment plant. So very engaging. We had almost 10,000 people click on the post. And like I said, 55,000 people saw it. The next one that you see here, the United for Infrastructure Week, this is one of our most popular YouTube videos. And we worked with engineering and asset management to get this created. This was one of their projects and working with JPIX, they were able to get this YouTube video created and it was very successful. It was one of our largest reaches. And then finally, our LinkedIn page. We have always had success on LinkedIn. It's just a very popular place for people to learn more about HRSD and what we're doing. But I definitely use this opportunity to increase our post on LinkedIn, just sharing more about what we're doing and also sharing the information that Layla sends out to us with her Swift in the News and HRSD in the News. So how we promoted these virtual opportunities. So we use social media, and then, like I just mentioned, we also connected with teachers and community groups through past collaborations. So this is always great because I had a pretty good list of teachers, groups that I've worked with in the past that I could reach back out to and let them know, hey, you know, I know schools are closed. I know you're not offering anything in person, but we have all of these virtual opportunities that we would love to have you participate in. So what you see here is a flyer that's pretty similar to the one that I sent out to them to just let them know about all the opportunities that we have and that I'm more than happy to present virtually to their classes. A word of mouth. So I'm also fortunate that teachers love to share good news. So when they have a great experience with education and outreach, they love to share it with other teachers. And because of that, I end up getting other teachers asking me to present to their classrooms. One of the other things that's great about this virtual setting that I've found is that I have an opportunity to reach more students. So in the past, I was always confined by time and the number of students that could fit in a classroom at one time. But now when I connect with the teacher for a virtual presentation, they can share that link with another teacher very easily. And when I think I might have 20 kids in a virtual presentation, sometimes I can have 60 because they've shared it with other teachers and they have the opportunity to see the presentation as well. We also rely pretty heavily on our partnerships. So our AskHRGreen.org partnership, our eMedia VA through WHRO, and then also the ERP Youth Reliance Clearinghouse. So they can share all of our lesson plans through their resources, which just helps kind of reach to a different audience. So here are some of the previous virtual outreach success that we've had. The infrastructure week that I mentioned with the very successful YouTube video and using social media to our advantage that way. Virtual presentations. So I have been doing virtual presentations since the pandemic and they've been turning out really well, which is exciting. So this just kind of lists some of the people that I've presented to so far. If you look at that picture at the bottom, that was one of the classes that I presented to. It was a fourth grade class in Norfolk. And you can see the little cup of materials. So this was really awesome because the teacher actually met with me so that I could give her materials for her students. And her assistant actually delivered all of the materials to make an aquifer in a cup to their students. So I was able to have a hands-on presentation with the students virtually. Which was really awesome and something that I've offered and encouraged other teachers to do as well. And the students had a blast. It was a really good time. So that's just an example of something that we've done there so far. And then up above is just the Swift virtual tour. I've been giving presentations on that as well. Upcoming outreach. So we have Engineers Week that's happening this week. The engineers are definitely spearheading it and communications is helping by promoting some of the activities that are open to the community and reaching out to students and letting them know and teachers about the opportunities that their students can participate in. And then I have a bunch of other virtual presentations scheduled, which I'm pretty excited for. This week, I'll be presenting to all of the Chrome Club students in the city of Portsmouth. So that's pretty exciting to know that that's coming up as well. They're learning about recycling. So we're talking about Swift and the idea of recycling water. And then virtual outreach in the future. Hopefully we'll be able to have a wastewater virtual tour. We're also working on more YouTube content. I was able to take a training just to learn more about YouTube and how to be more efficient in YouTube. So I've been working on that, sharing some online games. And we're also asking if you have the opportunity to share any of these with your networks and people that you know that would be interested in either the Swift virtual tour or just having kind of a free virtual presentation. So that's all I have. Do you guys have any questions for me?
Lacey, I think you should turn on your camera so they can just see your face.
Oh, yeah, sure.
That sounds like a fantastic program. When did you get started doing this?
Okay, I'm going to navigate this off. I'm going to try. So I started doing this virtual presentation pretty much when the pandemic began. I kind of tried to get busy with figuring out how I can still present to people and reach people. Sorry, guys, I'm trying to put my camera on.
You might want to stop sharing your screen, maybe. That will help you. That's all right. You don't need to if you can't do it, but
it would be nice, right?
That's right. No worries.
Oh, no, we're going to get it. Hi.
There she is.
I started this pretty much as soon as the pandemic began. I tried to figure out what we could do, and utilizing social media was pretty much the first thing that I tried to start doing because it was the low-hanging fruit. And then over time, I started figuring out how we could make virtual presentations. I had an amazing environmental education and outreach virtual conference that I went to, and it just gave me so many ideas and inspired me on how we can continue virtual education and outreach. So I was kind of coordinating the release of all of this with the Swift virtual tour. So that happened in the fall. So that's really when all of it took off.
Well, it really sounds fantastic. I think you're doing an excellent job.
Thank you.
Very impressive. Very, very well done.
Thank you.
He's a rock star.
All right. Keep it up.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Lisa. Right. That was wonderful.
That was item 4, and no votes are necessary. So we move on to item 5.
As soon as I can find my my screen again, there it's the order to disappear to. There it is. Okay, I should be seeing my screen again.
Got it.
Great. So item 5.
Yeah, we're on item 3. There we go.
Yep, just went to item 5. So item 5 is Elizabeth River Project sponsorship of the research pier and the recommended actions to approve sponsorship with naming rights of their Elizabeth River Project's research pier at their new resiliency lab on Collie Avenue at the $300,000 level. So they're building a new headquarters and a resilience lab on Collie Avenue. Incredible project. They've raised about $11 million, I think, for the building and for the programming. And one of the things they're looking for is a sponsor for this research pier. Jamie Mitchell and I were invited out to take a look at what they're, you know, nothing's under construction, but we looked at the actual site and found it's a great opportunity potentially for us to partner with them to really highlight the work we do in water quality research, which doesn't get as much attention. So Old Dominion's relocating one of their facilities on Collie Avenue closer to them. And the idea is to do a lot more research and partnership on water quality. VIMS is going to be there with a permanent monitoring site on that part of the Lafayette. So one question I had before the meeting was, what other naming right opportunities are there? I know this is pretty small. Let me see if I can make it a little bit bigger. These are the list of naming opportunities. The one highlighted, they have someone looking at that one right now. So Elizabeth, you had asked this question. So variety of naming rights right down to private offices. They're leaving no stone unturned, as good fundraisers do. I think, you know, the attraction to the research pier for us is that it's probably the most directly linked to our mission. From a water quality standpoint, we've always had a strong linkage with Elizabeth River Project. That is the body of water that we discharge, the single body of water we discharge more effluent into than any other body of water. It's, you know, just based on its shape, size, and location, the fact that we have Army Base and VIP both discharging into Elizabeth, we probably have a bigger impact on the Elizabeth River than we do on any other river that in our local area where we discharge. And their mission has been purely focused on water quality in the Elizabeth River. It's pivoting somewhat to a more resilience focus. And I don't know that we fit a lot of the resiliency piece as much as we do the water quality. So that was the attraction for us. And thought we'd leave it there and let you all discuss what you want to do. And if you decide you want more information, before you make a decision, we can have Elizabeth River at the next meeting if you'd like to do that as well. So that is where we are on this item. And again, our staff recommendation is that we go ahead and sponsor the research peer, which will continue to help us tell our story on water quality research.
This is Commissioner Lynch. Question, this support of that at the 300,000 level, that's not out of revenue, is it? I mean, it's not out of our fees that we collect from customers, is it?
Well, yeah, we can identify it as coming out of a variety of sources, you know, interest income, credit card rebate. There's all sorts of places we can take it, but essentially it's, you know, just how we account for that, where it started.
Generally, all of our receipts go into one pot and
exactly.
It would be a, you know, an operating expense.
Correct.
Commissioner Taraski, a question. You know, I went on the website just to, on One for Always, just see what other grant funding programs HRSD has. And Layla put a wonderful listing of, you know, the grant funding opportunities that all organizations have. And under the Strategic Environmental Grant Program, the maximum in awards is $50,000. On an annual basis. An organization can come back year after year and just put in a proposal for that dollar amount. So my question is really just focusing on the $300,000. Is that, I'm just trying to understand is, you know, what guidelines are we following to come up with that $300,000? Because as I said, the strategic environmental grants opportunities for, you know, all organizations to apply is the maximum is $50,000.
And so we don't view this as part of that grant program. And that's so that the what we're looking at is responding to a request from an organization. And as we evaluated it from a staff perspective, we thought that the benefits that we would get from this and the connection we have to the mission was worth this kind of investment. But that's up to you all. That's, again, our recommendation.
We've already had at least one naming opportunities in this area. What other naming opportunities has HRSD been applied to?
So we, you know, as I hit in the background here, back in the 2015 timeframe as part of Paradise Creek, when they were developing the education building as Paradise Creek Park, we funded that at $75,000. And when we did in 2010, the River Star Home Initiative, we funded that over $100,000.
So those are, an HRSD name is permanently on those?
On the River Star Homes, we were on the flags that they provided at the time. I'm not sure we still are permanently part of that. That was one that started off 11 years ago. And we haven't continued funding that. And once it got up and running on its own, we backed out. And then we are in the Paradise Creek education facility. Both the bathrooms tell our story. One is, you know, what's the biggest advance in water quality in the last 100 years? And we open the door and it talks about HRSD's treatment. And then what will it be in the next 100 years? And it talks about the Swift story and the other one. So we were able to work with them to get graphics produced and put in both of those restrooms at that facility.
So that's good. I view a naming opportunity as different from an annual grant opportunity because it puts us out there a lot longer. And anybody who walks through sees it then.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Is this a one-time gift? Is it going to be paid this year, or is it paid over several years?
We could do it either way. I think we've got the ability, again, through the reduction in some of the debt service costs that Jay was talking about, that we can absorb that in this year's budget and pay it out by before the end of this fiscal year, which would be our preference, but we can do it any way you would want. If you've got excess revenue over expenses, it's great to just use that in the current year than deferring this and making it an ongoing, you know, $100,000 a year for the next 3 years. Then we'd have to plan and budget for that in those future years.
Right. And Steb, Ted, just a little history. I'm not that familiar with it. You had mentioned Elizabeth River Project. Has HRSD also given at this level before to a nonprofit organization for a capital campaign?
Not in my time that I can recall. But, you know, I don't know that we've been approached by anybody either.
Right. That I can understand.
This is Commissioner Glenn, and I live literally right around the corner from that location for the new facility. And I can tell you the impact the bar had when it would park itself on Mayflower Road in Colonial Place. And I mean, I fully support their mission. I know it's a lot of money, but they do a lot of good. And I really see this as a partnership between the ODU, the community, HRSD, and the Elizabeth River Project. So it's a lot of money, but I think it's money well spent.
Any other questions? Hearing none, need a motion.
Leveston approve.
One more time, guys.
Leveston approve.
Thank you.
Lynch second.
All in favor say yes. Those against say no by roll call.
Glenn?
Yes.
Lakdawalla?
Yes.
Leveston?
Yes.
Rodriguez?
Yes.
Karoski?
Yes.
Ward?
Yes.
Lynch?
Yes.
Elifson?
Yes.
Thank you.
Motion carries. Go on to item six.
Item six is Central Trunk Interceptor Force Main Section A failure. This is a new CIP and initial appropriation. So the two actions are to approve a new CIP project and appropriate the total project funding in the amount of $650,000. So as we've done in the past, we have these emergencies come up. They exceed the ability of our operations budget to absorb it. So while we've paid for a lot of this work under our emergency procurement, we'd like to, from an accounting standpoint, establish a new CIP and pay for this out of capital as opposed to out of operating. This was the break that happened on Virginia Beach on Independence Boulevard there near Pembroke. It was quite a challenging event. Rainy weekend. Bridgman Civil was called in to help us and did a fabulous job. Bruce has actually reached out to them and thanked them again for the efforts they made there. This was quite, you know, we had to take all three southbound lanes of Independence and reroute them for like 3 or 4 days. Quite a challenge. The city was great to work with and the contractor worked well. We did lose about 280,000 gallons into the Lynn Haven, which caused a oyster bed closure for that period of time. Fairly reasonable to deal with as well. So, you know, all in all, we never like a break, but this one for the complication, size, and location went pretty smoothly. So this is just an accounting piece to create the CIP and appropriate some capitals to let Steve have enough money to make it through the rest of the year with his operating budget.
Your motion, please.
Motion to approve.
I have Steve Rodriguez as the motion.
Approve, Leveston.
Thank you, Commissioner Leveston.
All in favor say yes. Those opposed say no by roll call.
Glenn?
Yes.
Lakdawalla?
Yes.
Leveston?
Yes.
Rodriguez?
Yes.
Karoski?
Yes.
Ward?
Yes.
Lynch?
Yes.
Elifson?
Yes.
Thank you.
Motion carries. Item seven.
Item seven is LaSalle Avenue Boat Harbor to York Interconnect Force Main. So this is a CIP project and we're looking for the initial appropriation, the amount of $8,112,000 and an award to Kimley Horn for the design contract. You can see the technical points between Kimley and Michael Baker down to the 100th digit there. So a very close competition. So this project is an interconnect to move flow from the Boat Harbor area to the York River treatment plant service area. We'd like to take this to a PER stage, and then we're going to reevaluate, because there's a lot of debate as to, with all the other projects we've got going on, what utility and is this worth the dollars we'd spend on it. But we need a lot more information before we can make that decision. So we'd like to go ahead and get this going to get to the PER stage, and then we'll reevaluate at that point.
Any questions? Hearing none, need a motion.
I move approval.
Thank you. Taroski, second. Commissioner Taroski, second.
Mm-hmm. All in favor say yes. Those opposed say no. By roll call.
Glenn?
Yes.
Lakdawalla?
Yes.
Levinston?
Yes.
Rodriguez?
Yes.
Taroski?
Yes.
Ward?
Yes.
Lynch?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Elifson?
Yes.
Thank you.
Motion carries. Item 8.
Item 8 is our monthly update of our COVID surveillance work, and Kyle's ready to hopefully share his screen and walk you through what we're seeing. I think it's good news that we're all noticing that the caseloads are going down, but it's still challenging. With that, Kyle?
Mm-hmm. I think that was the update, Ted. You got it. Are you seeing the presentation now?
Yes.
Okay, great. So, yeah, this will be real similar to some of our other updates, and one kind of new piece of information, just a new analysis that we've done that we thought would be interesting for the group. So just to kind of jump right in, we've continued the same sampling scheme, sampling our 9 major facilities once a week. And the data that I'm going to show here goes up through last week on the 17th. So just kind of broad strokes, we have seen that continued decline both in the viral load in our wastewater, so the signal that we monitor, and also the clinical cases. It's kind of like a staggered sort of stepwise trend. You'll see it when I flip to this next slide, which is sort of interesting because some folks would tell you that that might just be an artifact of how the data are reported, the clinical data, but we're actually noticing it in our wastewater data too, which obviously doesn't suffer from that kind of confounding issue. So maybe it's just not quite a linear trend going down. But anyway, for context here, this is our regional new cases per day. And you can definitely see a nice trend going down there since the end of last year. And just for reference, this is the whole state, same metric, new cases per day, similar trend. So, you know, overall good news. Mm-hmm. So look at it by treatment plant catchment. You'll kind of see that actually this is the most recent data. So from the 17th, and these are the previous 4 weeks. And what you'll notice is actually we had a little bit of an uptick from last week, you know, but still overall down if you look farther back in time. So just the same information that you would get from that previous plot, but now with some resolution at like the catchment scale. One thing to point out here is, so Nansemond's catchment looks like things are going great, but actually I think that's an issue with the recovery of that sample. So without getting into the weeds, basically, the analysis of that sample was kind of inhibited, and that's going to get rerun. And just based on the trends for that particular plant, if you kind of just eyeball the colors for Nansemond the other weeks, I don't think it's likely we saw this big of a drop. So this is probably a little bit of a misnomer. So I just wanted to point that out. And then the figure that we've kind of been relying on to give sort of the view of the region, here's that same clinical case data in the bars, and in our wastewater data are these dots and lines. And what you'll notice overall, definitely a nice declining trend. So good news there, but a little bit of an uptick since last week. And I would say one plant, and I don't know proportionally how much Nansemond's signal will boost this, but it is likely to go up slightly because again, we're using sort of inhibited kind of suppressed value there. So just wanted to point that out. But overall, yeah, good news moving in the right direction generally. And so this is the new piece of information. And, you know, just kind of upfront, what this is going to show is that the relationship between the clinical case data and the viral load that we see is really strong, and stronger than it was back in October when we did the same kind of analysis. So most folks have seen a scatter plot, and that's simply what this is. Mm-hmm. So it tests the linear relationship between these two things. So basically, if you take every week that we've sampled, and that's what these dots represent, and match it up with a week's worth of regional data, so regional clinical case data, then you can plot the relationship over time. And so the only kind of difference here is that I've cut off data from before June, just because clinical testing was pretty low then, and that would have an impact on this relationship. So when you do that, you can also, you know, get something, get a correlation coefficient. So what that is just describing the strength of the relationship, and the closer that is to one, you know, the stronger it is. So what we find is the correlation coefficient there is 0.91, and the sort of using statistical jargon to explain that, what that means is that our wastewater data can explain something like 91% of the variability in the clinical data. So all that boils down to saying we have a really strong relationship between these two series, which I think gives us confidence that what we're doing is useful. And so the other piece of this is, and we've talked about this before, is you can also analyze and say, well, we really think that the clinical cases kind of lag behind changes in the wastewater signal due to some of the logistics of the course of the disease and also just the reporting. Previously, we thought that was around a week. And when you rerun that analysis with this larger data set, you find that that at a 1 week lag, you do see still a really strong relationship there, but it looks like it's shifting back. And that's just something that shifting back to a no lag. So kind of, again, to bring that back to plain English, the strongest association is with the series, these two series unadjusted. So this is something we're going to look into some more, not just as, you know, further evidence that this wastewater surveillance is a useful tool, but also to see, you know, is there a lag there, and how much can you know about upcoming changes? You know, maybe, again, you're not looking to predict actual number of cases, but big changes in your clinical data based on what you observe in the wastewater.
Hey, Kyle, sure. On that point, is it possible that you see more of a longer lag in clinical data on the way up, you know, as cases are being reported? And now that, you know, we've got so many cases and we're starting to reduce the amount of infection, but you still got, you know, some sort of residual in the wastewater maybe to close that gap. I don't know. It seems interesting that, you know, it's changed as we're on the way back down.
Yeah. So there's, yeah, two really interesting things there. One is the idea of a residual signal. So when I was sharing this with Raul, this was something we were talking about, and he brought up, which is that one thing we do know pretty well is that people who get infected with this virus shed it for a long time in their stool. So in fact, even after they've probably recovered, they're shedding it in their stool. And so there likely is always a residual signal in terms of when we say, all right, here's the viral load and here's the clinical cases, you know, kind of side by side on a plot. You might not call, you can't say that every one of these are active cases, and I would do air quotes since I got my camera on, active cases, like they're currently sick. And I don't even want to take a guess at what the proportion is, but what we do know is that, yeah, there is a kind of a long tail to that shedding time, you know, up to like a month. So definitely some residual signal in there that is a confounder. And maybe that would even get increased as there were more cases. But then, yeah, the idea that what does this relationship look like if you are on the upswing of a big peak or on the downswing? I think it would take subsetting it, just kind of cutting it up in a way that you just looked at those parts of the trend to really get an idea, because this includes all of that, right? This includes the smaller summer wave, both up and down, and then, you know, this one that we're currently in the middle of. Yeah.
Kyle, this is Rodriguez. Is there any way to quantify the number of people that we think may be affected by your research? Are we able to just put a number to it?
You could, yeah. So we have a basic, what we call prevalence model that doesn't use this exactly. It's more like viral density. So, you know, number of cases, or sorry, concentration you see in the wastewater scaled up by flow, and then, you know, divided by what we think the shedding rate is. We can kind of back into an estimate of, okay, yeah, you would need this number of people in, say, just pick Army bases catchment to see this concentration on that day, taking into account things like flow and the shedding rate that we think. So that's one way, and that's something that we've had. And then this is actually another way, right? So if you just take the equation of this line and the relationship truly is this strong, then you can take, you know, viral load and solve for clinical cases, right? So short answer is yes. And I just think there's, you know, there's caveats that go along with that, but you could get an estimation, yeah.
Sure, I'm just wondering from the standpoint, I know they talk in terms now that I guess all cases are not being reported based on the symptoms that these patients have. Some report it and some do not. So I think there's some kind of ambiguity about how many people have actually been affected by that. And I'm just wondering if we can add to the information curve what we find out and project those numbers out versus what's actually coming in that's been registered in the clinical setting.
Yeah, absolutely. So the interesting thing is using that first kind of way of doing it, we aren't inhibited at all by sort of inconsistencies in reporting. So that first method that we're calling our prevalence estimate model, that is solely based on wastewater data. So like the concentration in wastewater and the assumed shedding rate and flow. And, you know, that's it, right? It's not a complicated thing, and it doesn't include any clinical data. And so that one is really good because it doesn't have those confounders at all built in. You know, it makes other assumptions, right? Like you need to assume a shedding rate, and we try to model that to get some of the variability built in. But this version would absolutely be subject to any inconsistency or ambiguity of reporting because it does use clinical case data to establish the relationship. One of the things we do try to correct for when I put this together is we'll often scale up the clinical case data by a factor of like 0.3 because we think that there's something like 18 to 40% of cases are asymptomatic and may never get tested. You know, so we know just from that one, you know, holding aside any other confounders that are out there, we know just from the relatively high asymptomatic ratio of this virus that we're always going to be underreporting unless we really started testing broadly, including people who are not sick. So this relationship does include that attempt to account for asymptomatic, but it doesn't have any of the other, it can't really correct for any of the other ambiguities that you're talking about. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
And I understand that we would have to do it with a caveat because we just can't drill down on every household or every person within the household. And I understand that. There's probably a percentage loss somewhere along the line of what we're projecting. But I'm just curious how that compares to what they're saying. Medical data has been recorded who have actually been verified as having COVID. So I would think there's a definitely a greater number out there that have been affected than what we're seeing in the numbers.
Yeah, no, I think so.
Okay. Thanks, sir.
Sure. And then finally, one other piece of new info here. So we will continue to monitor these facilities, and we've continued to work with the health department and the CDC. We've been working with the new folks at the health department that I think I mentioned last week, who have the sole job of dealing with this wastewater data. So that's been early days, but good to have folks over there who are working on this, because, you know, we send them these data each week and, or yeah, each week as they get processed. And then this is something that Raul would be able to talk to in more detail, but I did want to give you the update that HRSD has begun validating assays to screen for the variants that we're seeing. So that's kind of the stage we're at right now, which basically what that means is that we have the set of assays, and our biologists are working on them to make sure that they're as reliable as the other assays that we use. So kind of understanding the nuts and bolts of how they work so that when we generate data using them, it's reliable. So kind of at the pre-testing phase, but you know, given those tests, we would be able to detect, I put the main variants of interest in just a couple examples that you probably heard of in the news, but there's actually quite a few. And I think that these assays will detect most of the ones that are kind of most prevalent. So there's been some interest from this, or interest about this from the health department and potentially from the State Board of Health. And so we will be pursuing this, and I'm not sure that we'll have preliminary data next month, but we might, by the time we give another update, be able to give some preliminary idea of how that's going. and so that's it. I'm happy to answer any other questions that might've come up.
Thank you, Kyle.
Sure. Otherwise, I will stop sharing.
Always fascinating.
I'll let you all move on.
Okay, we're moving on to next item, which is unfinished business. Is there any?
None that we're aware of. I think I updated everyone in my monthly report that we do have the Enabling Act, and Commissioner Levinson pointed out that it was passed by the House on the 3rd of February, not the 23rd, which is today. It has gone past through the Senate as well. So it's it should be signed into law with governor's signature, and it's got whatever, a couple weeks to make that happen. But on that, again, that takes effect on July 1st and has the changes we had talked about. So that was nice. The other piece is legislation that's trying to get us out of the floating cap challenges with the WIP 3 that was proposed by the administration. While it's not a perfect solution, there's a legislative solution that is still moving. It came through the Senate, actually came through the House fine. It's still, I think, working its way through the Senate. And it essentially gets us out of the floating cap concept, solves the WIP 3 issues for us, but still not maybe the best solution in the long term, but it's the best of the options we had at the moment. So we've been supporting that, and hopefully that'll get signed into law as well, and we'll have at least a defined clear path for meeting the TMDL.
Okay. Next item, is there any new business?
None that staff's aware of.
Commissioner comments.
Yes, this is Commissioner Lynch. I was a little disappointed to read about that Virginia Beach leakage in the newspaper before I heard about it from HRSD. Because it hit the newspapers pretty heavily.
Yeah, sorry about that. We'll try to get those leaks back out to you faster when they happen, but that was an oversight on my part. Apologize.
Okay, any public comments? None have been registered. So we'll move on. Information items, the various reports, any questions? Okay, then I'm gonna move into a closed session. So in accordance with section 2.2-3712A of the Code of Virginia, a motion is needed to go into closed meeting to consider acquisition of real property for a public purpose located in the city of Newport News, as provided in section 2.2-3711A3. Need a motion to move into closed session.
Everson moved to go into closed session.
Thank you.
Dr. Wallace, second.
Thank you.
All in favor to the motion say yes, and those opposed say no by roll call.
Glenn?
Yes.
Lakdawalla?
Yes.
Levinston?
Yes.
Rodriguez?
Yes.
Taroski?
Yes.
Ward?
Yes.
Lynch?
Yes.
Elifson?
Yes. Motion approved. We go into closed session. So walk us through what we need to do.
All right, hang tight for a minute. I think what I need to do.
Go into section 2.2-3712D of the Code of Virginia. A roll call vote was conducted to certify that, to the best of each commission member's knowledge, one, only public business matters lawfully exempted from the open meeting requirements upon this chapter, and two, only such public business matters as were identified in the motion by which the closed meeting was convened, were heard, discussed, or considered. Any commissioner who believes there was a departure from these two requirements shall so state prior to the vote, indicating the substance of the departure. So please say yes if you agree that there were no exceptions after Ms. Cascio calls your name.
Glenn?
Yes.
Lakdawalla?
Yes.
Levinston?
Yes.
Rodriguez?
Yes.
Taroski?
Yes.
Ward?
Yes.
Lynch? Let's see, is he on the line?
Was.
All right, we're gonna go to Elifson.
Yes.
All right, so we have
Mo's on, but he's mic is off.
All right, let me ask him to unmute.
There we go. Need a yes from you, Mo.
Yes.
Thank you. Okay, so no departures were noted, and go to announcements. We have a finance committee, a virtual meeting on March 4, again using Zoom, to review the CIP program coming up. And then, and all are invited to that CIP meeting. Then we have our next virtual commission meeting will be March 23. And otherwise, I will call us adjourned. Hit the gravel.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.